My parents cut me off, Trent said. He dug harder into the bar's cherry wood surface. I'm sorry.
Eh,
he shrugged. Their loss. Why'd they cut you off? I'm gay, Trent said. He said the words without wavering, as if he were just stating another fact, like the color of his eyes or what he had for dinner. From what I could tell, he was completely and proudly unashamed. I came out to them after graduation last month. Haven't spoken to him since. Oh, I said. I never would have guessed that Trent was gay, but to be fair, I didn't know a lot of gay people back home. It wasn't within my realm of possibilities. Of course, I didn't mind. Who was I to mind? Who was anyone? I was Iranian, and Jeanette was Christian, and Trent was gay. These were facts, and the world kept spinning. I leaned back against the sink, staring out the window into the dark night. Suddenly, I felt a gust of homesickness. I pictured my bedroom window, overlooking the usual suburban yard fare. Two-car garage, weedy lawn, our leaning mailbox of Pisa. I used to stare past the cul-de-sac, which connected to the rest of our quaint neighborhood, which connected to a small street that intersected our town's main street. There was an ice cream parlor at that intersection called Scoops, where I sometimes went with my mom. What if I was gay? I asked her once over a salted caramel cone. I was confident enough in my straightness as a 12-year-old to test my mom by joking about it.
Astaghfirullah!
Mom sighed. Don't say such things.
No, really, what if?
I was always thinking too much, but it felt okay to overthink when I stared out my bedroom window, or other windows, like the ones in classrooms, buses, or bars. I poked my mom.
Would you still love me?
Suck it, Bosh, she snapped. Stop talking. What if I only thought that way, through the literal medium of windows, because that was how society molded me to think? What if, thousands of years ago, one man looked out a window and thought, so he wrote about his thoughts, and someone later thought to paint the thinking scene, and someone else thought to depict a dramatic window-gazing thinking scene in a movie? And it proliferated decades of movie scenes, sometimes serving as a pivotal plot moment, sometimes just filling time, and eventually, this scene made its mark on me. And that was why I'd think the way I thought. Or thunk. Fuck. Maman, I said softly. She shut her eyes painfully, holding her breath for 2 seconds before releasing the pain.
Yes,
she said, utterly exasperated.
Of course. Yes, I would still love you.
I snapped out of my daydream when I realized that Trent had finished wiping down the bar. He was standing by the front door. I walked up to him. I don't care that you're gay. Trent half smiled. I don't care either, he said. And I don't care if you care. I stumbled home around midnight and fell into bed. My feet were sore, like I'd run the New York City Marathon and mixed drinks for all the spectators along the way. Equally dead was my phone. I plugged it into the wall charger and saw I had 2 missed texts.
I had fun, too. Wish we were able to spend more time together outside the bar, but it was an enjoyable night nonetheless. Although my lips are kind of chapped now, huh?
Jeanette. She was either making a kissing joke or a hangover joke. Or her lips were actually chapped. I cringed at all these possibilities. The second text was from her, too.
Want to do something today?
It was time-stamped 4:30, almost 8 hours ago. In my defense, I was busy working when her text fluttered into my very dead phone. Working my shift at my job, where I got paid in cash. I felt pretty legit. Instead of responding to Jeanette, I couldn't help wondering why Fiora hadn't texted me back yet. I dialed Fiora's number, no pickup. Maybe my phone was broken, so I found a payphone a few blocks from the hostel and dialed it there. She still wouldn't pick up. I became suspicious of the fact that payphones still existed in the 21st century. Shouldn't they be extinct? Clearly, I was too tired to think straight, so I went back to the hostel. I assumed Fiora had likely spent the entire day with Benji, having brunch and picking flowers and such, so I decided to text Jeanette back. Hey,
Sorry, was working all day today. How about tomorrow? She replied almost immediately.
Georgetown makes you work on Sunday? How un-Catholic of them.
Oh, shit. I forgot that Jeanette thought I was interning for Professor Mallard, which was only partially true. I replied,
LOL. No, I was working from home.
And she said,
Of course. Sounds like you're a hard worker, winky face. I get off work at 5:50 tomorrow. There is a 6:35 movie at the Georgetown AMC, which is approximately in between the two of us. Interested?
I groaned, shoving my head into my pillow. Did I really want to see Jeanette again? Monday was going to be my first day doing research for Professor Mallard. Fiora may have had a Benji, but did I really need a Jeanette? That's when I realized something. Jeanette was gritty. Not closed-minded like Trent had cautioned, but confident. The girl knew what she wanted. She wanted a summer of new experiences away from her Christian college. I could benefit from being around someone like that, with clearly defined goals. Also, I couldn't deny that I was a little attracted to Jeanette in, like, a rebellious Catholic schoolgirl way. So I replied, Sure, smiley face. Week 2. Chapter 17. When I entered Professor Mallard's office on Monday, I felt a crisp sensation of freshness, like I had stepped out of the shower and put on a brand new t-shirt. I felt clean. DC had given me a fresh start. It threw me into a cold washing machine where I tumbled around a ruthless cylinder of rejection, but now I could feel the positive effects. All that insecurity and doubt were purged from the fabric of my future. Sure, I had no passion, but that didn't mean I had to settle on a career I didn't care for. I needed more time. I needed to keep experiencing life through new paths like crossword construction, pickup dares, nightlife, drinking, even identity theft. Carlos Zambrano's 5 o'clock shadow was literally starting to grow on me. None of those paths qualified as a future career, and yet they helped me feel closer to the life I wanted. Something inside me was convinced I had the potential to change. I'd figure out my passion one day, but for now, I was living, and that was important. I couldn't tell you how my work with Professor Mallard would translate into my future, but I knew this. Grit was just one small piece. I was solving a much larger puzzle than I had originally anticipated. Professor Mallard led me into the office next to hers. It was a cramped and messy space. Nay, it was a disaster zone. I figured the last occupant must have gotten swept up by the micro-tornado that had clearly passed through. I took a seat in the swivel chair as Professor Mallard logged me into the computer. She noted that while I wasn't technically a paid research assistant, I should aim to research one new historical figure each day and summarize those findings in an email to her. Before I knew it, it was just me and a blank Microsoft Word document. I stared at the glaring white screen for a full minute before realizing that my first historical figure was obvious. The poet Ferdowsi. I already knew the gist of his story. I just had to fill in the gaps. I'd been surfing Wikipedia for an hour and was ready to dive into the 27 tabs I had opened from the citation links when I heard a harsh sob from the other side of the wall. My ears perked up. Professor Mallard? I knew it was wrong of me, but I pressed my ear against the wall. I was never very good at resisting curiosity.
God, Bridget, you wouldn't believe how difficult these last few months have been. One day I'm fine, and the next day I'm falling apart. Is he? Is he really in a better place? He was one of the happiest men I knew. He existed in a state of pure happiness. Now he doesn't exist. No. Yes, Bridget, I would say that. Yes, that is what I mean. He was my rock, you know, Bridge? God, I'm such a mess. I'm always wired tight one way or another. Tight as a bowstring. He always said that. But he never accepted that as a permanent state. He made me more adventurous, spontaneous. I'm a fucking mess now.
I ripped my ear away from the wall,
I couldn't believe it. Professor Cecily Mallard, the world's leading adolescent psychologist, was having an emotional breakdown. And rightfully so. From what I could tell, her husband was dead. Gone. I took a deep breath, exhaling slowly, and refocused my eyes on the computer screen. Under my breath, I whispered a small prayer for Professor Mallard. One more breath, I thought to myself, and back to work. Dear Professor Mallard, thank you again for letting me work on this project under your guidance. I want to emphasize that you are making a difference in my life. Today, I researched the renowned Persian poet Ferdowsi. His masterpiece, Shahnameh, is the national epic of Iran and took 30 years to write. He wrote tens of thousands of lines of poetry about kings and queens and the hardships they endured in the name of Iran. Ferdowsi was a brilliant, gritty man who created gritty characters for a country of gritty people. Technically, his stories are myths, but when you're caught up in fiction for that long, it becomes someone's reality, right? My findings are attached. I have to admit, I was distracted by another important and gritty person today. You. I am not going to spend my time here researching you, of course, because that would feel creepy from 5 feet away, and I presume you already know everything about yourself. But I want to point out that you are one of the grittiest people I have ever met. You earned 3 degrees from Harvard and have dedicated your life to a noble field. I hope that in 500 years, another runaway is writing his research summary email about your poetry of grit. Sincerely, Scott Ferdowsi. Jeanette and I met up after work to watch a movie. I got to the theater early, and she arrived exactly on time. It was a romantic comedy where the girl conspires to win over the hot guy's attention, and the girl fails over and over, until the very end, when the hot guy professes his love for her, but she picks her best friend instead. The entire time, Jeanette couldn't keep her hands off me. She alternated between holding my hand tight and stroking my inner thigh, slowly and rhythmically. After the movie, we went out for overpriced cupcakes. I paid for both of us, which took a hit on my wallet, but what was I going to say? Can we split the check? I'm trying to budget better so I can make my runaway money last. Then we went back to Jeanette's place and made out tamely on her bed. Well, I kept it tame. I was thrown off guard by how far she wanted to go. Jeanette tried getting other body parts involved at least 3 times, but I respectfully declined. Chapter 18. Tuesday, I was bogged down by a case of the Tuesdays. Texted with Jeanette in the morning, told her I was researching Martin Luther that day. Won some major Christian girl points. Learned Martin Luther had dropped out of law school when he was 21, against his parents' wishes. His father hoped he would become a lawyer. Said hello to Professor Mallard, asked how she was doing. "Excuse me?" Her eyes shot up. "I was wondering if everything was, all right in your life." "As a matter of fact, Scott, I've been dealing with a major loss lately." "Oh." Pause. "I'm sorry." "Don't be sorry." Smile. "It's why I took you on for this project. After he died, I lost my focus. Your enthusiasm for my work, it revived me, unexpectedly." Got shifty and changed subjects. Finished up my work a little early that afternoon. Found a bench at Georgetown. Attempted to solve the Washington Post crossword puzzle. Kept getting stuck. Called Fiora each time I got stuck. No pickup, again and again and again. Attempted to pick up where we left off on the puzzle we started constructing together. No luck there either. Another date with Jeanette in the evening. Free show at the Kennedy Center's Millennium Stage. Beautiful venue, adorned with the richest red curtains I'd ever seen. But subpar folk music performance. Blech. Told Jeanette I had a headache, which was actually kind of true. Rushed back to the hostel. Called Fiora one more time. No pickup. Left a voicemail. "Hey." My voice trailed off. "It's Scott. Surprise me sometime." Hung up.
thought about calling again, but maybe Fiora was sending me a message. I hoped she was okay. I hoped she was okay with me. Chapter 19. Wednesday morning, I heard my phone vibrating from my bed when I got out of the shower. I groaned. It had to be Jeanette, following up on my pretend headache. I took my time drying off and putting clothes on before I climbed up my bunk for my phone. 2 missed calls. Fiora. I dialed back immediately. She picked up on the 3rd ring. Hello? She croaked. Fiora sounded surprised that I had called her back, almost frightened. There was something feeble about her voice. Hey, I replied quickly. I heard heavy breathing from the other end. Hey, she said, warming up. Is everything okay? Not really, Fiora said. I had an accident. I'm at GW Hospital. I jumped out of my bunk bed, grabbed my wallet and keys, and stormed out the door. I'm on my way, I said before hanging up. I didn't miss a beat. I just missed Fiora. A stranger at the corner gave me directions to GW Hospital. I sprinted toward Washington Circle, which was on the other end of New Hampshire Avenue, a straight shot from DuPont Circle. Fiora always made me run in D.C. A million possible scenarios played out in my mind. I wondered if Benji had abused her. He was being an asshole Saturday night, and I hadn't heard from Fiora since then. It seemed unlikely, though, if she had just made it to the hospital. Did Fiora do drugs? Perhaps she'd overdosed. Or maybe it was a regular old accident, like a broken arm or fractured wrist. Maybe she was crosswording too hard. No, stop. How could I be so flippant about this emergency? Fiora was in a real-life hospital. I was lucky she was alive. Holy fuck, I finally thought. What could she have done? I stumbled through the hospital doors and slipped on the floor. A nurse came over to help me up, and I immediately told her I was there to see Fiora. Let me check with the front desk, the nurse said calmly. I followed her to the receptionist, emphasizing that I needed to see Fiora right away. They looked up Fiora's file and said she was okay. I processed those words. Okay. So it wasn't a freak accident. Okay was better than she's not okay, or we think she's going to make it. They asked me to take a seat for a few minutes. Okay, I replied. There wasn't a single comfortable couch in the waiting area. I tried all of them. Every couch was too firm. I adjusted my butt, tried sitting crisscross, wedged my hands under my quads. Nothing worked. I didn't know whether to attribute it to the couches or nerves. Instead, I stood up and tapped my foot incessantly to unwind the tenseness. Maybe I was building it up, or both. It was like a yo-yo, wind, unwind, wind, unwind. I wondered briefly if Dad was doing the same thing in Iran, squirming in an unforgiving hospital chair, waiting for news on Baba Bazorg's health. Breathe in. Breathe out. Pretty soon they let me into Fiora's hospital room. I never would have described Fiora as pristine and angelic. Fiora herself would scoff at those adjectives. Sure, she had cheeks like a cherub, but the second she opened her mouth, it was all edge. In the hospital bed, though, lying there, she looked nothing but innocent. Any impulse I had to scream, "What happened?" or "What the fuck?" or "Are you all right?" vanished. And for a long moment, all we did was rest in each other's silence. In each other's confused, exhausted, "What are we doing in this room?" eyes. It was my first time making eye contact with Fiora since she disappeared from St. X. And I had nothing to say. She spoke first. "Don't flatter yourself," Fiora muttered, her eyes dropping. "What?" "I know how you're looking at me. Like it's your fault I'm here." She breathed heavily, carefully. "It's not." I inhaled, then exhaled with my words. "I tried calling the past few days." "I know. And if I know..." I couldn't reason with Fiora. That wasn't what she needed right now anyway. She was putting up a guard, and I could tell it wasn't a stable one. Fiora needed me as a friend. She needed some of my momentary stability to rub off on her. So instead of asking questions, like why Fiora didn't pick up my calls, or how she wound up at a hospital, or what inspired her to call me instead of someone she knew better, instead of saying anything, I sat gently by Fiora's side and held her hand. With crossword puzzles, I always saw Fiora's brain as this badass, indestructible assembly line of downs and acrosses. But sometimes, assembly lines break. That's why we were at the hospital. Fiora didn't get into a car accident or anything physical. The wheels were in her head. She had a mental breakdown.
"Fucking Benji," Fiora said.
She buried her face in her exceptionally pale hands, whimpering softly. Then she finally opened up. Fiora met Benji 4 months ago in Intro to Sociology. She was the student, he was the teaching assistant. Benji was older than Fiora by about a decade, which I thought was funny because Benji is the kind of name you hear on the playground. He's the twerp who pushes kids down the slide before they're ready. That's Benji. Fiora's Benji was the son of a Belgian diplomat and was getting his PhD in sociology and marijuana, she told me. He made the first move. Fiora was never much of a class-goer, so Benji asked her to come in for office hours after the third week of classes. He demanded an explanation for her absences, and Fiora, desperate for an excuse and someone to talk to, told him about her mom's letters, how they'd caused her so much stress. Benji looked at her with a combination of pity and intrigue. Without batting an eyelid, he urged Fiora to reconnect with her mother.
He was so confident with his prescription that I made up my mind. I booked a trip to Philly, she said wistfully.
The next week, Benji invited Fiora over to his apartment for a glass of wine. One thing led to another, led to his bedroom. It was 100% consensual, she assured me. 2 weekends later, Fiora saw her mom and her new family for the first time. It went better than she could have expected. Her mom hugged her tight, stroked her hair, and apologized in all the right ways. She was clean and even volunteered at a rehabilitation center for drug addicts. Her husband managed a chain of grocery stores, and they had the sweetest 2-year-old. But still, when Fiora came back to D.C., something didn't feel right. Her heart thrashed against her chest, and her vision turned splotchy. Fiora hadn't had panic attacks since she was 15, so she checked herself into the hospital. She didn't want to call her dad. She'd never told him that she was visiting her mom in the first place. So she called Benji. After he came to her side, their relationship changed. At least it had from Fiora's perspective. Benji became a constant presence in her college life, one that hadn't included many friends up until that point. Benji was different from the pre-meds and sorority suckers. He had edge. He was an adult. They kept hooking up, and Fiora kept seeing her mom in Philly. And for the rest of the semester, life was peachy.
This summer, though, we've been fighting. That's why I stole his bike in the first place. After he'd made a couple of douchey comments in a row, Fiora said. The morning after St. X, he broke up with me. I was half awake and he just started yelling at me about how I acted around Quentin the night before, telling me I was immature, just looking for attention, that I would never amount to more than an atom in the universe.
Fiora's voice was so faint I could barely understand what she was saying. Why would he say something like that? I asked.
An atom in the universe, just one atom. Because he believes things, Socket. For a while, I liked that about him. He had firm opinions. His confidence, it was dickish and arrogant, but I told myself it would always soften for me. I thought I was his exception. Of course, now I see that I was being delusional.
Fiora rose slightly in the hospital bed, narrowing her eyes at nothing in particular.
I don't need a fucking trust fund baby telling me I'm worthless. No one deserves that. I spent a lot of time thinking about myself these last couple days. My sense of self-worth. And then Benji called this morning all, "What's up, babe?" as if nothing had happened. I told him he owed me an apology, and the balding bastard had the gall to demand one from me. So I hung up.
I bit the inside of my lips, afraid of saying the wrong words.
I should have felt like a champion, right?
Fiora said, her eyes reaching.
I felt like shit. Then I went to check my email and... Do you remember the puzzle I wrote last summer? The one the New York Times accepted?
I nodded, hesitantly.
Well, they take forever to actually publish them, sometimes years. After I got off the phone with Benji, I found out they're running my puzzle in the paper next week.
Fiora! I burst out. That's incredible news!
She looked at me with ferocious gratitude and a dollop of pride. Thank you.
I don't understand, though. How did you get from there to here?
Socket, I couldn't even muster a smile. That's what did it. I knew I should have felt happy for myself. I just couldn't. I thought about taking another dose of my antidepressants and anxiety meds, but I stopped myself and came here instead.
Empathy stirred inside of me.
I wanted to tell Fiora she was a warrior. I wanted her to know I was proud of her for telling off Benji, for the puzzle that would be printed a million times over, for taking care of herself. But I didn't want to overstep.
Why did you call me? I asked gently. My voice was hardly audible over the ambient noise of the hospital. Heart rate machines beeped in the background. It struck me that each rhythm was unfazed by the others, like blinking car turn signals. That every one of these sharp beeps belonged to a person who, like Fiora, had endured. This seemed like a profound realization at the time. Fiora looked off to the side.
I would have tried calling Trent, but he has an important networking event today at the Cato Institute. So I called you.
And your dad?
She rolled her eyes. He's useless. My dad was never very hands-on with his parenting.
But shouldn't you let him know
that I'm in a hospital bed? I'll tell him later. Maybe tomorrow. He'll pretend to be concerned, ask if I need to switch therapists, switch my medication or something. He'll pay the hospital bill and send more money. He's too busy with the paper business and his rotating cast of big-boob bimbos to actually care, Socket.
Once again, I was at a loss for words. I didn't know how to react to the reality that there were parents out there who didn't prioritize their kids over all else.
I couldn't believe that wasn't a guarantee, a constant in Fiora's life.
Your dad, I said, searching for the right words. I guess he just...
I promise you, he doesn't care. When Grams died and my mom left, my dad shut down and never rebooted. I told him I was seeing Mom again. He knew about the letters. And all he had to say was, make sure to let Dr. Daniels know. That was always his style. He'd send me to shrinks, and of course, shrinks don't know how to parent. So they did what they do best.
Bullshit, I said.
Prescriptions, Fiora said. The most fucked up cocktails of medication. More pills than anyone should see in their lifetime.
I thought back to my session with Dr. Sparrow. How I expected her to take one look at me and cry, Adderall! Two a day! All your problems will be solved! Because what I wanted was a quick fix. An easy way out. What's easier than popping a pill? I straightened my back a little bit. Fiora continued.
Between therapy and crosswords, I've stayed pretty sane. But Benji broke me. God damn it, Fiora, I whispered under my breath.
She nodded. I felt a rush of blood to my head. I also felt relief. Half my relief was for the wrong reason, for my own mental health, a privilege I had always taken for granted. But the other half was for Fiora. I don't understand how a girl like you could let anyone affect you like that. She pressed her eyes shut, bobbing her head back and forth slowly.
Well, she said, opening her eyes, it happened.
I squeezed Fiora's hand, because the tighter I held her, the more confidently I could guarantee she was alive, that she would be okay. Fiora spread her fingers free.
I guess the cat's out of the bag then, isn't it? She laughed softly. I'm not such a free spirit. Life gets to me. Sometimes. I take my downs and crosses seriously.
Guess so.
Guess so,
she echoed.
Almost simultaneously, we both let out a deep breath. She looked down at her fingernails. I cracked my knuckles, two by two.
Hey, I said, poking at her with hopeful optimism. Now that you're going to be a published cruciverbalist, I think we need to celebrate properly.
Oh, yeah?
Fiora smiled. And so began the rest of our day. The nurse walked into the room, and Fiora asked her for paper and a pen. She winced a little when Fiora said the word pen, because pen equaled potential harm. But she brought us one anyway. Fiora flattened a sheet of paper on a book and drew a large gridded square. I'd learned a lot since our last crossword session, and Fiora had been through a lot. So we started over. Every now and then, as we constructed this new puzzle, our hands and arms brushed. When this happened, I didn't pull back. Neither did Fiora. Instead, we would both freeze, on purpose. It was like each time our bodies touched, someone whispered into our ears, "Let the moment happen." And then Fiora would tilt her head, and I'd wonder again, should I pull back? But I didn't. So Fiora kept smiling, and we kept freezing together. And we melted into puddle after puddle of puzzle ink. Chapter 20.
Goodness, that's right out of a movie.
I was back at Professor Mallard's office Thursday morning, filling her in on Fiora's incident and the whirlwind day that followed. I felt guilty for skipping a day of research, but Professor Mallard didn't seem to care. She was fascinated by my story.
So you're telling me, she continued skeptically, Fiora, this girl you befriended by chance on the bus to D.C., she had an anxiety attack yesterday morning, and you were the first person she thought to call?
She doesn't have the best relationship with her dad, I said. Professor Mallard's eyes wandered off to the side. That's a shame. Fiora doesn't really have a lot of friends, I explained. At least from what I can tell. Just this one guy, Trent, who she grew up with. He moved here from Charleston, and I think she has some crossword puzzle friends. I mean, I don't think she wants more friends. She's incredibly spontaneous. One of those really independent, confident girls. I've only known her 1 week and, well, I can't help but feel lucky. She's definitely pushed me out of my comfort zone in some ways, I said. I chuckled to myself. There was no way I could tell Professor Mallard about Jeanette and the pickup challenge and the night at St. X. Anyway, I can't help but worry about her after yesterday. Professor Mallard was still staring off to the side of her desk.
Where did the crossword puzzles come from? She asked absently.
Oh, man, Fiora is obsessed. She's been solving crossword puzzles since she was a little girl, and now she writes them. She's a really good constructor, I said.
Professor Mallard looked back at me and forced a smile.
The psychology of puzzles is interesting. Many studies link puzzle solving with exceptional cognitive skills. Memory search, problem solving, facial recognition, intuitiveness.
What does that say about Fiora? I asked impatiently.
What do you think?
I gave Professor Mallard a funny look.
You're the brain expert.
I wouldn't worry about Fiora, Scott. Of course, it's within reason, as a friend, to be worried after her breakdown yesterday. But the way you describe her, with this penchant for crossword puzzles, her brain is wired a certain way.
She likely moves fast, yes? She likely makes quick, intuitive decisions.
Professor Mallard hadn't even met Fiora yet, and she understood her better than I did.
So you're saying she's likely impulsive? I asked. It made sense. All signs up until now pointed to Fiora being 100%, no telling what she'll do next, impulsive.
I'm saying, the same way she jumps from box to box, puzzle to puzzle, it's likely she's already moved on from yesterday's incident. She has a bigger issue than this ex-boyfriend, yes, but she'll deal with it. The irony is that you're still worried about her.
I bit my lip. I worry a lot, I said. We were thinking the same thing.
That's why I'm here in D.C., in your office, because I couldn't stop worrying about my future.
because I was desperate to get Gritty. Professor Mallard smiled in a familiar way. Her smile had arms, and they wrapped around me and squeezed tight. It was my mom's smile, the way she smiled on my first days of school and my birthdays. Growing up smiles. That thin and sympathetic curvature of the lips always said the same thing. You'll be fine. Growth mindset, Scott, Professor Mallard said. Everyone worries and everyone fails. I get it. Professor Mallard pressed down on a stapler. She tilted it over to reveal a single staple, which she swept into the waste bin. Failure isn't permanent, she said. Grit is the ability to learn and fail and learn some more. That ability is fluid, not fixed. You have the power to change. Dear Professor Mallard, last week, Fiora mentioned a gritty artist named Marina Abramovich. I'd never heard of this woman, so I decided to focus my research today on her life and art. I was astonished with what I learned. Marina Abramovich is a world-famous performance artist who, time and time again, has pushed herself to the limit and passed it for her work. She is very avant-garde. In her first performance over 40 years ago, Abramovich cut herself 20 times with 20 different knives. She recorded the sounds and tried replicating each cut, not because it looked gory or cool, but to explore her body's limits and her state of consciousness. It's meta, isn't it? The performer is the performance, and as a viewer, you're supposed to get inside her head. What is she thinking? How does she go on? How is she making herself go on? Is she even thinking? Abramovich has put on hundreds of other thought-provoking, inflammatory, sometimes literally, performances over the decades. She has disciplined her mind in the most unique way to let her audience's minds run wild. My findings are attached. Sincerely, Scott Ferdosi. As I was closing out my tabs, Professor Mallard poked her head in the door. Marina Abramovich, she said, giving the cluttered office floor a look of disapproval. Interesting choice. I shrugged. She looked up, just barely missing my eyes. You know, Scott, my dad was a big fan of hers. I haven't jumped into your research yet, but did you happen to come across her bow and arrow piece? Of course. Rest energy. Yes! Professor Mallard's face leapt, and our eyes finally met. My dad was simply obsessed with her Ulai collaborations. He believed they were too good for this world, Marina and Ulai, as artists and as a couple. They sure were something, I said, remembering how they had walked the length of the Great Wall to end their 12-year relationship. They were absolutely nuts, but so were my parents. When I was 7, they recreated Rest Energy for Halloween. My mom carried the bow and Dad carried the arrow, and every house we stopped at, he would load the bow and pull it back and aim it at her. And they'd laugh like maniacs. Trick or treat! Can you imagine? I was mortified. By this point, Professor Mallard had fully entered the office and was actively recreating the scene, pulling back an imaginary bow and bending over to laugh herself. They were intellectual goofballs, she said, bent over her knees and shaking her head. As grown up as you could be in Oakland back then. What did you dress up as? I asked. I think I was a surgeon that Halloween, Professor Mallard said, moseying back toward the door. I believe that's what I wanted to be at the time. Her expression turned sober, finished with the story, but still longing. Thanks for your help today, Scott. I headed straight to Tonic after a full day at Georgetown. I had a 6-hour shift ahead of me with Trent. I was working hard these days, but I liked my work. Fiora had already called Trent and told him about everything that had happened the day before. What do you think is next? Trent asked, stacking clean glasses behind the bar like a house of cards. I thought he'd stop at the second or third level, but he moved on to the fourth, very precarious. She keeps on keeping on, I said, quoting a cheesy Tumblr post I saw once. No, I mean with like, you and DC, you and Fiora. She's officially single now, you know. I sighed and pressed the glass I just right against my forehead. I don't know. I'm pretty happy these days doing research with Professor Mallard and working with you. And with Fiora, I don't even... I mean, even if I did, like...
Like what?
Like, look at me, I blurted. She wouldn't go for me if I did. Trent stopped wiping the bar and tossed his dirty rag at me.
Hey, buddy. Scott.
He put his arm around my shoulder the way a coach does right before giving a pep talk, which was exactly what I was getting.
I don't know if you realize this, Scotty Tuhati, but you're a fucking catch. A jawline like that? Man, you could cut a marble statue with it. Your olive skin? Damn, share a little with pasty old Trent. And those green eyes? Boy, oh boy, I feel sorry for all the girls who got lost in those eyes. May they rest in peace.
I closed my eyes, laughed, and shook my head. But Trent kept going.
Plus, you've got an actual personality, which beats most other guys. All you need is some confidence.
Where do I get that? I asked. As if confidence were something you could buy off Amazon. Free 2-day shipping.
You'll find it when you need it, he said, slapping me on the back so hard I bumped into the bar, which sent his tower of glasses tumbling down.
Fortunately, none of them actually fell to the ground or broke. We laughed tremendously. At the end of my shift, Trent pulled out a small wad of cash.
Here, he said, counting 5 crisp 20s. $100. Good work today.
I'm confused. That's double what you paid me on Sunday, but I only worked half the hours, I said.
You earned it, Trent said.
I never had a job growing up, so earning money was a new concept for me. My parents were by no means rich, but they had a strict internships-only rule, because anything else would distract from my studies. Salaries meant nothing to me. I'd never seen $10 an hour or $60,000 a year in material form.
I don't deserve this, I told Trent. Definitely not this much.
Come on, man. You're doing a good job, he said.
But, Scott, here we go again. Confidence. Confidence, Trent repeated. You need to stop seeing yourself as a pansy and start seeing yourself as the badass runaway rock star that you become.
That's very nice of you, I said. He shoved the money back in my hands.
Here, take it.
I counted the money in disbelief. 20, 40, 60, 80, 100. All of a sudden, I experienced a feeling that could only be described as ecstasy. Like the drug. I'd never tried ecstasy, but Kevin's cousin did it in Europe, and he told us it felt like the most attractive girl in the world had just given him a compliment. That's how I always pictured confidence. And $100 and a pep talk later, that's how I felt. Confident. I even quashed my what-if doubts. I considered them, sure, but I squashed them with a series of so-whats. So what if my confidence was shallow? So what if it was a placebo? So what if it wouldn't last forever? I knew I hadn't quite swallowed confidence yet. I was just getting a taste, but I nonetheless savored the moment with a grin. Trent noticed.
There we go, he said, smiling. Right on, buddy.
But, oh Lord, what about taxes?
Ha! Fuck Uncle Sam. You're dealing with a libertarian, remember?
I chuckled. A libertarian who wants to run for office? I could blackmail your future campaign.
And you're a runaway who won't admit he likes my best friend, Trent shot back. I could blackmail your operation, too.
We entered an intense staring contest, which I, of course, lost after, like, 4 seconds.
Fine, I said, giggling helplessly like a toddler.
I won't tell the government. And I won't tell Jeanette, Trent said. Or Fiora.
He stepped out from behind the bar, untucking a shirt along the way.
Our stupid little secret.
At the end of the night, I dragged myself back to the hostel. My body ached with exhaustion. The last 2 days had been such a whirlwind that I'd forgotten about my phone, which died God knows when. I plugged it into the wall outlet and crawled into bed. I was dozing off when I heard my phone fire off.
Buzz, 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 buzz.
I must have missed a lot of calls or texts.
From who? My parents?
Reluctantly, I climbed down from my bunk bed to check. I had an onslaught of text messages from Jeanette. 11. 11 individual messages.
Wednesday, June 30th, 3:01 p.m.
Had a wonderful time yesterday. Hope you are relieved of your headache.
Wednesday, June 30th, 3:04 p.m.
LMK if you have any free time after work today.
Wednesday, June 30th, 6:01 p.m.
I'm sure you are swamped at work, but I sincerely hope to hear back tonight.
Stuck out tongue smiley face.
Wednesday, June 30th, 8:05 p.m.
Scott, is everything okay? Did the headache manifest into something more serious? I have an hour for lunch tomorrow, so if you're not feeling well, I can bring you soup or Advil. Let me know.
Wednesday, June 30th, 8:11 p.m.
Just let me know you're all right.
Wednesday, June 30th, 8:50 p.m.
Scott?
Wednesday, June 30th, 10 p.m.
Perhaps you had a grueling day of research. Sorry for the incessant texts. I'm just a bit puzzled.
Thursday, July 1st, 7:01 a.m.
Strange that I haven't heard back from you.
Thursday, July 1st, 7:02 a.m.
Happy July.
Thursday, July 1st, 12:02 p.m.
Scott, please let me know you're all right. Or if you would rather not see me again. I can't say I am not a little bit worried.
Thursday, July 1st, 9 p.m.
OMG! I'm so sorry. I had dinner at Tonic tonight, and I saw you working behind the bar. You looked so busy. I didn't know you worked two jobs. I'm so, so sorry for bugging you. I can only imagine how busy you must be. Reply when you have a free minute, dear Scott.
Did someone die?
The guy in the bunk below mine, a long-haired hippie who was in town for a protest, looked on with concern as I read Jeanette's texts.
No, no, I said, wiping the horrified expression off my face.
By this point, I should have ignored Jeanette or just cut things off. I should have replied saying, hey, you're great, but I'm not interested. All signs pointed to Jeanette being crazy anyway, crazy obsessed with me. But I didn't want to shoot down her persistence. I had to admire it, right? She was being gritty, and grit should pay off. So I texted her back. Hey, yeah, been swamped with my two jobs. Should have mentioned that earlier. Coffee this weekend?
Chapter 21.
Holy shit! Who was calling me at 6 in the morning?
I climbed down from my bunk to unplug my phone from the charger. It was Fiora.
Hello? Is everything okay?
Sock it, she cheered. I cringed at her enthusiasm.
Good morning. How's my favorite DC runaway doing?
Kicking myself for picking up the phone, I said as I climbed back up the ladder.
Are you still in bed?
It depends, I said. I lay on my back, staring at the ceiling. I followed the white wire around the edge of the room all the way to the corner where Fiora was sitting a week ago.
Do you need me to get out of bed?
Suck it. I don't feel comfortable dictating your bed activities, Fiora said.
I was speechless. Literally. My jaw dropped for about 3 seconds.
However, if you are so willing, my crossword buddies and I are puzzling in DuPont at 7 a.m. if you'd like to join.
That sounds fun, but, why?
Because, she paused. The last time I called you this early, it was for something depressing. I wanted to fix that.
How are you feeling, by the way?
I closed my eyes, picturing the white hospital sheets, white walls, white gown, and our black and white grid.
Better?
I'll feel better if you join me at 7. I bit my lip, containing a smile that surged throughout my body. I could feel Fiora smiling through the phone, too. I had to go.
Okay, sure, I said coolly.
Inside, I was leaping for joy. I heard an extended beep. Fiora had hung up. I would see her before work. There was something invigorating about D.C. so early in the morning. You could hear chirping sparrows just as plainly as roaring Ford Escalades carrying bureaucrats. It was a short walk to DuPont Circle, but I made the most of it, taking long strides up New Hampshire and thinking, for the first time, that maybe I was better off here in D.C. than in Southeast Asia with Jack and Kevin. If my friends believed they were experiencing foreign cultures abroad, they clearly hadn't met Fiora's crossword buddies. I had figured out early that Fiora marched to her own drumbeat and didn't get along with her classmates. She made those points very clear. But I still expected her to have cool friends. Other people who hated other people and marched to their own percussion instrument. I figured that among the 1% of her classmates who didn't suck, there might have been a few who also liked crossword puzzles. Maybe those friends did exist, but they weren't who I'd meet today. That became clear as soon as I saw Fiora in DuPont Circle. Suck it! She perked up in an uncharacteristically friendly way, like she was actually happy to see me, like she had dropped her poker face at the crossword table. Fiora pulled out a chair for me. Guys, this is Socket. The guys appeared less enthusiastic. There were three of them seated at the table, all middle-aged, balding, cookie-cutter dorks. Hello, I said, and I repeated it after a few seconds of awkward silence. I sat down in the plastic lawn chair Fiora had pulled out for me. One of the men greeted me with an inaudible mumble. He was busy organizing a thin stack of papers. The other two kept their heads down, fiddling with their fingers. One played with his thumbs in a masturbatory thumb war, and the other was cracking his knuckles, two at a time. Obviously, I could relate to their fidgeting, but still, social awareness is a thing. The guy with the papers suddenly jerked his head left and right, like a paranoid alien, before standing up. He cleared his throat.
Ahem. Welcome. Let us begin today's fun with some anagrams.
Fiora leaned over and whispered into my ear, "That's Eugene. He's the leader of this whole mafia. We all pitch in puzzles and take turns printing, but he runs the show." Eugene looked exactly like you'd expect a Eugene to look. Bald, pasty, and white, with a turtly head and gentle blue eyes. His demeanor was almost as square and straight edge as his checkered shirt, which was buttoned all the way to the top.
"I prepared a roundup of some of this year's most noteworthy pop culture icons. May we begin?"
"Aw, come on, Eugene," Fiora said, leaning back in her seat. "Don't you want to tell us how your week was? Anything exciting?"
Eugene shriveled his nose. "It was fine," he said dryly. For the group leader, he wasn't much of a talker.
The guys, Fiora told me, called themselves the Crossword Crusaders, something to do with the sword part of crossword. I imagined they had a secret handshake and gang symbols and such, but I didn't get a chance to ask. They jumped right into their anagram activity, which, contrary to my first impression of the group, was actually a lot of fun. Eugene would say an anagram like,
"So long, Lane Skew,"
and give a description like,
"She's a popular R&B singer whose sister is married to Sean Carter."
Answer, Solange Knowles. I got one or two of them, which was one or two more than I was expecting to get. We blew through about a dozen anagrams before Eugene revealed the answers and declared Stu the winner. Stu was a funny dude. He wore a short-sleeve Hawaiian button-up shirt with a rubber ducky-themed tie. He also had these humongous, thick-rimmed glasses that kept sliding down the bridge of his nose, and every few seconds he would push them back up.
"But he's a crossword BAMF," Fiora whispered in my ear. "He can solve anything you give him in 10 minutes or less."
The time came to put that claim to the test. After the anagrams, Eugene pulled out a paperclip stack of papers from his heap and passed one sheet to each person, face down. I could see through Fiora's that it was a crossword puzzle. I used to do this with quizzes and exams all the time. I'd lean in a little closer to the exam and try to decipher a few of the questions before we were allowed to flip it over. Who was I kidding? I still did this. No one's perfect, but so many people pretend to be. That's why I liked Fiora. She lied, stole, manipulated, teased, and broke down just like everyone else. But she was an honest liar, self-admitted thief, and straightforward tease, and transparent manipulator. And like the rest of us, she had bad days.
What about the third guy? I whispered to Fiora, pointing at the Humpty Dumpty-looking man on the other side.
That's just Charles, Fiora said, not really whispering. He's a total loser, as you can probably tell, but what you can't tell is he writes these trippy puzzles that are surprisingly fun, if you're high enough.
Charles leaned over. I heard that, Fiora.
Love you too, Charles, Fiora joked. You're my favorite weirdo constructor.
Charles winked back at Fiora.
Eugene shot a harsh look to our side of the table.
Ready? Begin.
Charles, Stu, and Fiora immediately flipped their sheets over and attacked the puzzle. Eugene didn't get one because he constructed the puzzle, and I didn't get one because I wanted to watch the first time around.
There are an awful lot of threes, Stu mumbled under his breath.
Shit. There are a shit ton of threes, Fiora said, tapping her pen furiously. Way too many threes. She bounced her pencil from box to box. Each time she'd draw tiny vigorous circles in the air before filling in the boxes with invisible letters. Sometimes she wrote the letter down, but more often than not, Fiora just shook her head and hopped over to the next clue. I took a peek at her grid and imagined the thought process behind each hop. The third letter in 43 across has to be a T, I thought. But 27 down is TR blank M blank blank. And the last letter in 43 across intersects the third letter from 27 down. So first, I should figure out the remaining two letters of 27 down. Then I'll figure out all the other words that intersect 27 down. And I'll have more context for 43 across. My head was already hurting from the crossword logic, which seemed more complex than an IKEA instruction manual. I looked over at the group of men playing chess about 30 feet away. Those guys had nicer chairs than we did, not to mention proper stone tables with superimposed chessboards. Our table was one of those cheap plastic ones you'd buy and keep in your storage shed for when you're really desperate.
Cocky chess freaks, Fiora muttered. She must have caught me staring.
Whoa! I looked down at Fiora's grid, and somehow, in the time that I got distracted by the cocky chess freaks, she'd gone from an empty grid to halfway done. Fiora was hopping and nodding and filling in squares with real, not invisible words. Something was definitely going right, or at least in the right direction. I started nodding in support, chock full of secondhand adrenaline, knowing that even though it wasn't exactly a competition, Fiora could actually win. Flip. Showing no reaction whatsoever, Stu flipped his puzzle over. He was finished. He checked his watch and marked the time. 6 minutes and 43 seconds. Fiora wasn't kidding. This guy was fast. No one looked up to congratulate him. No one was jealous. Nothing. And Stu didn't seem to care. He simply took a sip of his iced tea. And you know what? That was what got him. As soon as he gulped the tea, Stu's eyebrows shot up, as if the bittersweet drink caught him more off guard than 100 random clues. Crossword puzzles were supposed to be Fiora's way of taking the world less seriously. Yet here she was, stressing out over the one in front of her. Her pencil hovered over the grid as if casting a spell, expecting the words to magically appear in their boxes. All of a sudden, she stopped hovering and pounced at the grid. But a minute later, she retreated, rubbing her temples in defeat. Meanwhile, Charles bounced his eraser and nodded in unison, all the while twirling his pencil intermittently and filling in some squares. Even Eugene picked up his pencil and tapped it against his head every now and then. These guys were all fidgety with their hands. Maybe it was a cruciverbalist thing. Then it hit me. These were Fiora's friends. Not the future dickheads, or the imbeciles, or the fraternity bros and sorority girls, but three middle-aged crossword dudes at a picnic table in DuPont Circle, sitting in the shadows of the cool kids, a.k.a. a slightly less scrappy league of Bobby Fischer wannabes. At least those guys had proper chess tables. But despite their shortcomings, the crossword crusader's spirit never waned, and Fiora was never nicer to me. She never appeared more comfortable or at ease, it seemed, than she was around puzzles. Crossword Fiora was a gentler Fiora. 20 minutes later, she turned her puzzle over, and shortly after, Charles either admitted defeat or finished up, too.
It appears all pens and pencils are down, Eugene announced. Shall I read out the answers?